Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we can certainly reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Well, since it's February, it makes sense to read stories about love and romance. Here's one entitled, Dazzled by the Girl Across the Aisle. Not only did they both work at the same store, but they also had plenty of other things in common. This story was sent in by Richard B. Whitaker. As Thanksgiving 1963 approached, I was standing in front of the festively adorned grandeur of the May Company store, where I had been an employee for a year, having started as a stock boy and then moving up to sales. My mind slid back into the past as I remembered how the journey began. In the winter of 1962, I graduated from high school and decided to attend Brigham Young University in the fall. Unfortunately, that experience lasted only 5 days, since homesickness overshadowed my desire for a college education. Then, just before Thanksgiving kicked off the holiday season, I learned that the May Company store near my home had openings for stock boys, so I decided to apply. Dressed in a suit, white shirt, and tie, I drove to the store. After identifying the location of the personnel department, I confidently rode the escalator to the second floor. Standing before the receptionist's desk, I told her that I wanted to apply for a job. She smiled and asked me to have a seat. A few minutes later, following a brief interview with the personnel manager, she smiled, shook my hand, and welcomed me into the May Company family as their newest stock boy assigned to the women's shoes department. My baptism by fire in the world of retail began as Thanksgiving approached, and on short notice, I received a promotion to a sales position in the stationery department. While working in stationery, I associated with some wonderful people, including a longtime school friend named Carol, who worked in the fashion accessories department just across the aisle. As the holidays approached, I noticed a cute petite blonde often talking to Carol during their break time. Although she wore an employee tag and looked somewhat familiar, I felt that this little blonde beauty with the perfectly coiffed flip and radiant smile probably had more dates than she could handle, so I hesitated to approach her. However, one afternoon, I slipped across the aisle and asked Carol the name of her blonde friend. "Oh, that's Cheryl Angel," Carol answered with a twinkle in her eyes. "She was a cheerleader at Grant and a semester behind us. Don't you remember her?" "Just the name, that's all." Although I often saw Cheryl when she visited Carol during their breaks, I made no effort to talk to her until Carol walked over to my counter one slow night as New Year's Eve approached and asked, "Why don't you, Cheryl, and I take a break later and get something to drink downstairs in the restaurant?" "You think she'll go?" I answered sheepishly. Carol grinned. "Well, when I told her that she needed to meet the cute guy who worked across the aisle from me in the stationery department, she smiled and said, 'I'd love to.'" Later that night, over a Coke and a bowl of split pea soup, Carol introduced me to Cheryl. When our break ended, Carol went in one direction, and I followed Cheryl to the second floor. After clocking out for the night, I asked her if she was busy the following Saturday, January 4th. She smiled and said, no, why? Well, I've been thinking about going down to Wallach's Music City in Hollywood to see about buying a new Martin guitar. Would you like to go? I'd love to, she responded. Where do you live? I asked. On Hatteras Street, near the KMPC radio towers. I began to laugh. And you? She asked. I live one street away on Miranda. A look of fleeting astonishment crossed her face. Okay, another question. She smiled, cocked her head to the side, and replied, I'm ready. When's your birthday? May the 27th, 1945, she answered. And yours? May the 27th, 1944. No, she said. You're not serious, are you? I'm very serious. It appears that we were born on the same day, a year apart. Attended the same junior high and high school, only live one block away from each other, and we're now both working at May Company. Then, wanting to keep the mood light, I added, there can be no doubt in your mind that ours was a match made in heaven. She blushed as we both continued to laugh. Saturday came quickly, and I had no difficulty finding her house. As we pulled away from her home, I asked, did you have your mind set on shopping for a guitar? Only if you did. Well, I have a better idea. I've wanted to see the movie Tom Jones for quite a while, and it's still at the Victory Boulevard drive-in. Is that okay? That's fine, she said softly, as she slid across the bench seat in my parents' 1955 Buick. After a moment, she reached over and cranked up the volume on the radio. As the song, He's So Fine, by the Chiffons began to play. Then she flashed me a quick smile. I was smitten. As 1964 rolled on, it wasn't long after our first date that Cheryl confided in Carol that, quote, I was riding down the escalator to the first floor not long after the three of us took that break together, and in my head I heard the words, that's the man you're going to marry. As we dated, I would on occasion peek at her small brown 1964 desk calendar. I noted that at the time we had our first date, her social calendar included the names of 8 different eligible young men, each of whom she currently dated. By September 1st, I appeared as the lone survivor. During the next year, our romance flourished, so just before Christmas, I asked Cheryl to marry me. We set the date for January 18th, 1965. We held the ceremony in the home of my parents, with only 14 family members invited to attend. We purchased our wedding sheet cake from Alpha Beta for $2.50, and as for a honeymoon, we couldn't afford one. To say that our life together began in a remarkable way would be an understatement. Nevertheless, after 58 years of marriage, and a family that includes 7 children, 21 grandchildren, and 10 great-grandchildren, I will be forever grateful that she chased me until she caught me. And as we both look back over the years, we agree. Ours was a match made in heaven. And this was Dazzled by the Girl Across the Aisle by Richard B. Whitaker. And now this story, entitled An Engaging Evening, From Square Dance Partners to a Couple for Life. This story was written and sent in by Sarah Etkin Baker. It was Saturday night and Valentine's Day as I entered the old town hall, scene of the annual Valentine's Day square dance. My heart was aflutter because I would spend the entire evening dancing with Bill, the man I'd been dating for the past few weeks. We had met while taking square dance lessons at a local single square dance club, inexplicably drawn to each other and instantly hitting it off. I couldn't tell you for sure exactly what it was about him that captured my heart. Perhaps it was his sparkling blue eyes, his red hair, and neatly groomed beard. Maybe it was his spirit of adventure, his high energy, and his soulfulness. Whatever the attraction was, I didn't question it. When we danced, the world around us disappeared. Time and space lost their relevance, and I melted into his heart. I walked into the dance hall and was immediately greeted with warm smiles and friendly faces. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Bill standing with some other men at the refreshment table. Our eyes met, and he rushed toward me, picked me up, and rambunctiously twirled me around before gently returning my feet to the floor. Just then, the caller turned on his microphone, his voice crackling over the loudspeaker. "The next dance begins in 5 minutes, so gentlemen, find yourself a partner and square your sets." Bill took my hand in his, and we formed a square with three other couples. The music began, as did the caller's instructions. "Bow to your partner, bow to your corner. Allaman left, weave the ring." Time stood still as Bill and I floated effortlessly across the dance floor, lost in our synchronized movements, unaware of anyone save for the distant sound of ladies' petticoats swishing and men's boots shuffling across the shiny wooden floor. I was on cloud nine, for we were sharing a fun and lively evening together, just as I had imagined it. But as the night went on, I couldn't help but notice Bill was acting a bit strange. He seemed uncharacteristically nervous and kept looking at his watch. As the last dance of the night was announced, Bill took my hand and led me to the center of the dance floor. The music slowed down, and just as the music was about to end, Bill got down on one knee and pulled out a small velvet box from his pocket. "Sarah, from the moment I met you, I knew you were the one," he said, his voice quivering with emotion. "You make me happier than I ever thought possible. Will you do me the honor of becoming my wife and being my square dance partner for life?" Tears welled up in my eyes and streamed down my face. I nodded and said, "Yes, absolutely, yes." The crowd erupted in cheers and applause as Bill slipped a delicate ruby and diamond engagement ring onto my finger. Bill's proposal made it the perfect Valentine's Day. Bill and I married just 2 months later. We have shared a lifetime together, a lifetime filled with soulfulness, love, happiness, adventure, and the occasional misadventure. After 43 years, my heart's still aflutter because I have the privilege of dancing through my days with Bill. And this was An Engaging Evening by Sarah Etkin Baker. And now this story entitled A 1940 Love Affair. The heartfelt letters kept their love alive until they could be together for good. This was sent in by Susanna Bianchi. Years before I was born, my mother stood on the platform alongside my grandmother and watched my father's train pull out of the station, holding back her tears as she had promised him. They had gone to Washington, D.C., to see the Lincoln Memorial before he left to be a soldier, is how she put it. She stood on that platform waving, even after the train was out of sight, just in case he could still see her. They had no idea when they would see each other again. "To my darling Frankie," she would later write, "how handsome my husband looked in his uniform. You made me so proud." And he'd reply, "My dearest girl, I never saw you look as beautiful, and to think you are all mine." She often let on that she was worried he would forget her once he met all those pretty English girls. "Not a chance," he would write back. "No one can come close to the sweetest wife a man could ever call his own." They lived for each other's letters. We can only imagine what it was like then, since hardly anyone writes letters these days, especially love letters. "The only thing I loved more than your father back then was when the mailman delivered his letters," my mom told me when I was barely more than a cub curled at her feet. I loved hearing my dad tell the story of how they first met, how his knees almost buckled when his sister Mary introduced them. "She made my heart pound like a drum," he would say, slipping his hand beneath his shirt to fake a thump. "When I finally got up the nerve to ask her out on a date, what do you think she said?" Even though I knew the answer from hearing the story so many times, I'd say, "What, Daddy? What did Mommy say?" "She said, 'Well, it's about time. And what took you so long?'" He would laugh at the memory whenever he told the story. After that, they were inseparable. "I happily courted her," my father said, "the sweet young filly that she was." My dad's pet name for my mother was Ricky, because he said she was also his best friend, not just a pretty girl he could show off on his arm. He would tease her, telling her if he hadn't been lucky enough to woo her, she might have gone off to Hollywood, just like the actress Hedy Lamarr, who everyone said she looked like. My mom, Ania Paulina Palvario, was 17, and my dad, Frank William Karneski, was 21 when they got married in 1940. While he was stationed in London with the Royal Air Force, my mother lived in Connecticut with her mother-in-law, who treated her like another daughter. My mother learned to cook my dad's favorite dishes, like pierogies, stuffed cabbage, and baked glazed ham, although she never told him how many pots she burnt in the process. When my mom would cry while trying to make a dish, Grandmother Mary, who had a great sense of humor, would laugh and say she needed to stop crying because her tears were adding too much salt. She would then encourage her to just try again. My mother eventually became one of the best cooks around, another source of pride for my dad. Mom was always romantic, lighting candles and making certain she looked her best June Cleaver, as she would put it, when my dad came home from work. Grandma always said that no one loved a man the way my mother loved my father, and she said the same about my dad. "I never saw two people more in love," she would say. When my dad came back from England for good, he brought my mom a double strand of pearls that she would wear every evening. They belong to me now, and I, too, cherish them. Whenever I wear them, and someone comments how lovely they are, I always say, with a twinkle in my eye, "If they could only talk, imagine the tales of love and romance they could tell." And this was a 1940 love affair, by Susanna Bianchi. And now this story, entitled Meeting the Parents Between Seasons. 50 years ago, these two found love amid their coaching duties. This story was written and sent in by Karen Hughes. Talk about two different worlds. Ronnie and I were the poster people for opposites. He came from the small town of Carbon, Texas, and he had 11 people in his high school graduation class. I came from a St. Louis suburb, and I had 600 in my class. But somehow the stars aligned just right, and we both ended up coaching in Longview, Texas at the same time. We were miles and miles away from either set of parents. We met the end of April in 1972, and by the end of May, we had decided we were going to get married. Since neither of us had met the other's family, we figured that was the next step. We would have to squeeze in a visit once football was over. After the spring football game, we headed west to Carbon so Ronnie could introduce me to his parents. We arrived at 3 a.m., not exactly an auspicious beginning. Ronnie's parents, Oma May and Jimmy, were very gracious. They got out of bed, threw on robes, and joined us in the living room for the formal introductions. Ever the perfect hostess, Oma May offered us refreshments, and we all chatted while enjoying a piece of her famous chocolate pie. Around 4 a.m., the adrenaline wore off, and we were all yawning and struggling to stay awake. Jimmy was the superintendent of schools, and Oma May was a teacher. Jimmy said they could be a little late for school, and we should all sleep in. I took their advice and slept in. I got up at 10. They and Ronnie, on the other hand, thought that sleeping in meant getting up by 7. Boy, was I making a good impression. The good thing about my laziness was that it gave Ronnie a chance to tell his parents that we were getting married. I didn't have to worry that they would look disappointed or skeptical when they found out about our plans. After all, we had only known each other for 1 month. When I finally got up, Oma May was in the kitchen. She greeted me and said, "I understand that you're going to be our daughter. There aren't any girls in this family, and Jimmy Hughes is going to spoil you rotten." I couldn't have hoped for a better welcome to the family. Best of all, it was true. We talked about a fall wedding. Fall is my favorite season. Ronnie agreed until he mentioned to his head coach that we were getting married. Clint looked at him strangely and said, "You'll be scouting in Lamarck," which was 250 miles from Longview, 3 times this fall. "I don't think anyone will marry you over the phone. You better get married before coaching school." That meant we'd have to choose a date before the 3rd week in July. Wow, getting married after knowing each other 10 weeks was scary. It was time to plan a trip to St. Louis. One set of parents down, one to go. Ronnie had to wait until the beginning of July to meet my folks. He was taking an extra college class. He had a long weekend for the 4th, so we planned accordingly. My parents didn't know that I was bringing home my future husband, so that was already established. During the 12-hour drive, Ronnie kept saying that he wished he was more like his brother, Donald. Ronnie was very quiet. He didn't enjoy being in big groups or really even talking to strangers. He worried. "I'll be hiding down in the basement the whole time. Donald would be joking and entertaining. He'd have them eating out of his hand." My mom had organized an engagement party for us, inviting family and a few old friends to a restaurant in our South St. Louis County neighborhood. It went well. Ronnie did fine meeting all the new people that were thrust on him. They did most of the talking, so he could just smile and nod. The funniest part of the party was when the waitress was serving a tray full of drinks. When she walked behind Ronnie and me, she tripped, slipped or misstepped. Whatever caused her to juggle the tray, the result was a pitcher of ice-cold tea cascading down my back. After the initial chilling shock, it was kind of funny. The rest of our time there went well. People brought gifts to the house, so Ronnie got to meet most of the family for a second time. He felt more comfortable the second time around. It was a quick trip. It took 12 hours to get there, 3 days to meet the family and friends, and then another longer drive home. We had to stop in Tulsa, Oklahoma on the way back to get our marriage license. They required blood tests and then a 7-day waiting period. We chose to get married in Tulsa because my college best friend's dad was a minister. I'd spent a lot of time with him when I was in college, and I wanted him to perform the ceremony. It was sort of a neutral spot, too. Ronnie's parents and brother would have a 6-hour drive. My parents, sisters, and grandma would have a 6-hour drive, and Ronnie and I would have a 5-hour drive. Everyone was happy with the arrangements. When the car loaded to head back to Texas, I gave my mom and dad a hug, and I said, "See you next Wednesday." My mom dropped her arms and looked thoroughly confused. "What do you mean?" "We'll see you in Tulsa next Wednesday, the 12th. I told you that we were getting married in Tulsa at Dr. Ruth's church." "Yes, you did, but you didn't say what date." Oops. And this was Meeting the Parents Between Seasons by Karen Hughes. And thank you for joining me today. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.